you know, it's been deemed impossible by many. And then even till today, I still have people that tell me, you know, it's not possible to do this, but we've cracked it.
You're listening to the Constructing You podcast. Hi, I'm Eleanor Mosher, and I'll be sharing the stories of the people behind the projects. You'll get to hear interviews with exceptional leaders and industry titans in the construction and development space. I don't only want to find out what they do, but who they are and who they had to become to achieve what they have. You'll get insights, ideas, and advice that will serve to construct your career and life to reach new heights and show you what's possible. Let's go on this journey to construct ourselves together. You ready? This podcast episode is going to take you on a fascinating rollercoaster ride. We explore the depths of underwater maritime construction through to desert construction through to what it means to be a high performance entrepreneur, right through the depths of your mind and what happens at the intersection of construction and technology through to artificial intelligence. This is a fascinating interview that I am so excited for you to listen to. My next guest is Renee Morcos, the founder and CEO of Alice Technologies. Renee also teaches at Stanford University's PhD program in construction management. The son of a civil engineer, Renee grew up in the construction industry. He has worked on construction projects worldwide, and his professional experience ranges from working as a project manager in Afghanistan to building an underwater pipeline project in Beirut, from driving automation engineering on a $350 million gas refinery expansion project in Abu Dhabi to leading the development of a virtual design and construction model for Amsterdam's cruise ship terminal. Renee received his PhD in construction engineering and management from Stanford University, his MSCE in construction management from USC, and his BS in civil and environmental engineering from American University of Beirut. If that already hasn't taken you on a whirlwind global adventure, then buckle in because, like I said, prepare to be fascinated. This interview is like no other, and Renee just provided so much generosity in the depth of his answers. Step back and look at the person that becomes when a person follows their curiosity, when they say yes to following a bold vision, when they want to go where no person has gone before, when they are seeking to be the pioneers and the drivers of change. It's not just what they've done, but who they've had to become in the process. So listen very, very closely to what Renee has to say, because like I said, fascinating is only the start. If you love what you're listening to, make sure that you share it with your community so we can have an ever-growing industry of constructors who are dedicated to being exceptional, excellent, and exemplary people behind the project. Make sure if you do, say hi on LinkedIn. I'm Eleanor Mosher. And of course, do connect with me on Instagram at @EleanorMosher_ and tell me what you loved about this episode. Without any further ado, here is to Constructing You with Renee Morcos. Good morning, Renee, and welcome to Constructing You.
Good morning, Eleanor. Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. And could you just remind the audience which part of the world you are joining us from?
I'm calling in from Silicon Valley, the center of the tech universe, so to speak.
That it is. And there are many contech and proptech enthusiasts as alike who do frequently listen in. So we're very much looking forward to getting your insight. But to start off with, could you share with the audience what is really unique about Alice Technologies?
Oh, yeah. So Alice Technologies has developed the world's first generative construction simulator. And so what that is, it's a technology that allows you to ingest a construction project and then simulate its construction millions of different times or ways. You can build a construction project with one crane, two cranes, overtime, no overtime, 10 crews, 20 crews, 30 crews, fast drying concrete, regular concrete, large cranes, small cranes, and so on and so forth. The possibilities are really endless. And then you can build this project over and over again thereby figuring out what is the most cost-effective or time-effective way to build your project. So that's kind of what we've built. It's never been done before, definitely a unique piece of technology that we've invented. It's taken me 13 years, so definitely a couple of weekends, as we like to joke. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's been deemed impossible by many. And then even till today, I still have people that tell me, you know, it's not possible to do this, but we've cracked it.
Well, of course, it's not possible until it is actually done. So correct me if I'm wrong, but on a practical understanding, what you're doing is, you know, you're telling the software, this is what I want to build. You're telling it its parameters, and it will give you the most efficient and effective manner in which you can construct that building.
Yeah, exactly. The software has sort of three phases or three pages, as we refer to them. And what we did was we separated the rules that govern a construction project from the solution to those rules. Right? And so that, you know, doesn't make too much sense, you know, to most construction people off the bat. But what it effectively means is focus on how, what you want to build and how it needs to get built, right? And what I mean by that is that tell me what tasks do you need, what resources do you need, what resources are available. But don't crunch that information together. Let the software do that. Let the software do the heavy lifting of figuring out which specific sequence, which, you know, resources are assigned to which task, and so on and so forth. And so step one, you set up the rules. Step two, you let the computer crunch all the constraints for you, generate lots of options. And then step three, analyze the results, right? So you look at a schedule, a 4D video that's automatically generated, and you figure out, you know, this is the way that I want to build a job.
What do you think would be the real benefit if there was whole-scale uptake of this across the globe?
The mission statement of Alice Technologies is to reduce the global cost of construction by 25%. And that's what I believe this technology will enable, reducing the global cost of construction by 25%.
And from clients that have obviously already taken on this software on board, what benefits have you seen to how their business operates or how they run projects? What are the benefits down the line?
Yeah, so you'll tend to see an average duration savings of about 17% today. And you'll see about a 13% saving on labor and equipment. Labor and equipment are roughly about 60% of the total. So somewhere around 7 or 8% on cost savings at this point. Those are the few benefits that we see.
Well, that's fascinating. And I feel like I should just sign up and have this rolled out everywhere, because I can just imagine the upfront pain that is removed from planning construction projects. And what it would also do is let people get back to their zone of genius, which is actually building construction and using software to complement that.
Yeah, absolutely. The funny thing about it is that we've, you know, in the last 6 months, several people have sort of reached out to us and said, you know, I never thought I'd say this, but I actually like scheduling. Yeah, it really, the approach, it's exactly what you're saying, right? We stopped referring it to as AI or artificial intelligence, but IA, intelligence augmentation, right? And so you'll notice even in the three steps that I talked about, humans, let the humans do what they're good at, right? Experience, gut sense, communicating, collaborating, risk analysis, you know, those things humans are very good at, understanding reality, right? Let the machine do the one thing it's good at, which is crunching numbers, right? And so when you put these two together, that's where kind of the sparks fly, the magic happens, right? And so definitely what the machine will do is it will crunch all these, you know, constraints for you and let you focus on really, you know, what I think is the fun part about building, which is, hey, how do you want to build it? What are the trade-offs you want to make? Do you want to take higher risk, you know, for lower duration, lower risk for, you know, longer duration? Like, where do you want to put the risk? Where do you want your buffers to be? You know, those are the, I think, fun questions that you can start asking and answering with this kind of technology.
I'd like to see that in this decade, it will again become a norm and really change how we approach building construction. But for the audience to get to know you really quickly, let's lay some fast foundations. You ready?
Yep.
Where did you grow up?
Dubai, Prague, Czech Republic. Dubai, Prague, Beirut. That's it.
And where do you live now?
Silicon Valley.
And what's your superpower, Renee?
I invent what hasn't been invented before. Like, I create something out of nothing.
That is an imperative superpower. What's one of your favorite books?
It's blanking on the name. Not Built to Last, the other book he wrote.
Good to Great?
Exactly. Yep.
What are you most challenged by right now?
I think the regular rigor of entrepreneurship, right? And so, you know, just continuing to kind of, you know, build the business as it's starting to scale. So, you know, scale produces a lot of interesting problems, and that's kind of what we're experiencing.
And one thing that you are learning right now?
Oh, yeah, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. Delegation, right? Do not do everything or try to do everything. You have a group of very talented people at the company, and let go, you know?
Well, that is imperative and a very valuable lesson to scaling, because if you as the entrepreneur is still doing what you were doing, you know, 13 years ago, then the company doesn't grow and we all fall into this zone where, you know, it's hard to let go in the first instance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's your baby, right? You put so much into it. So, but you know, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I've got a very understanding team, thankfully.
What's your favorite achievement to date?
Yeah, I mean, other than Alice, you know, I mean, that's been a labor of love. You know, I think I built the first windows and doors factory in Afghanistan. That's something I'm really proud of. You know, 17 million, at the time, it was 17 million people had access to modern windows and doors, which really changed the temperature performance of their houses.
Wow. I don't think anyone will ever get to say that again, obviously, but that's obviously part of your career trajectory, and we're going to get into that in a moment. But before we do that, what's one of your favorite buildings or projects?
Okay. So the first project I was ever given, and I was, you know, 22, and I was told to build a bar out of a crashed airplane on Kabul airport. You can make this up, but, so we ended up cutting off the wings and kind of putting them on top of each other, and because they're curved, so it was kind of tricky to make them like the bar itself was these airplane wings. But that's kind of, I think, the favorite project. I think total value of job was maybe like, I don't know, $10,000 or something like that, because the plane was free.
I'm stretching my imagination to visualize what that looks like, but tell us more. Your career has seen your operational experience range from underwater maritime to desert construction to Himalayan war zones. So please do tell us more about the different operating environments and very unique situations that your career has taken you to.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, what I've always enjoyed is the edge, right? It's kind of pushing the boundary. Right. I mean, you know, anywhere you put me, I'll kind of go and tinker around with breaking things. And so for me, I've always been driven, you know, when I thought of my career as a construction person, I was like, well, you know, I could go and build, you know, ski resorts in the Alps with helicopters. Right. I could go. I was looking at saturation diving. Right. You know, being underwater for, you know, 2 weeks in one of those chambers and welding underwater. Right. Or, you know, Afghanistan, right? Wartime, you know, crisis zone construction, also a big deal. So those were sort of the things I was looking at. I got to experience underwater construction. You know, this wasn't saturation diving. This was just paddy, but it was a sewer pipe that they were kind of installing, you know, in Beirut at the time. That was incredibly fun. You know, I never liked school, which is funny because I'm a professor now, but I would kind of cut class and go build things. You know, I would pick the coolest projects in town. And I would go knock on their door and be like, hey, do you guys need any help? And, you know, they'd usually say no. I'd say, what if I work for free? And that would kind of get their attention. And I'd kind of get quote the job. And, you know, I'd usually get a little beer money at the end of the month. But, yeah, I worked on this underwater pipeline. That was incredible, right? Got to see, like, the challenges, you know, wind, waves, you know, underwater, you know, construction, safety, you know, that whole aspect. You know, went to, you know, desert construction. So, you know, worked on a $350 million gas refinery. You know, I've got to say that's also really extreme. You know, you've got 6,000 people, you know, 300 miles from the closest, you know, civilized facility, right, where they're literally burning through $1.6 million a day, right? I mean, just the scale is incredible, right? You know, and then, you know, took a job in Afghanistan as a private contractor, you know, helping rebuild the country. And so, tried a lot of different hats, and it kind of naturally progressed. Started as an assistant site foreman, became a project manager, managed several projects, you know, and kept going up the ranks. And what I really started to get interested in is how do companies run, you know, and I didn't spend 5 years in school in my PhD. I did 6 months on, 6 months off. I kind of worked for 6 months a year and kind of paid for the program that way. Highly recommend it to anybody that's kind of thinking of a PhD. It really worked really well, and I still completed in 6 years, which to my understanding is the average. But yeah, started getting interested in ERP systems. How do you know, set up the system that manages a company, right? You know, daily reports, monthly reports, you know, cost codes, estimates, schedules, So started playing a lot with like virtual design construction, 3D, 4D, line of balance scheduling, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, really enjoyed what I was doing. I really liked it. Ended up spinning, you know, Alice. Like I started working on how do you optimize construction, right? I started working on how do you optimize construction. And the thing that I noticed at the time was that construction sites are empty. Right. And so, you know, drive down a highway and look at any construction project and you'll notice like lots of empty space. You know, rarely do you see it kind of teeming with workers. Right. And so I started measuring, found that 3% of construction space is used for construction on average. Right. It's kind of crazy. Right. So 97% of construction site space is empty. And so I started to, you know, develop algorithms that would increase space usage and then kind of stumbled back upon the original problem that I had seen in Afghanistan, which is, how do you get a computer to kind of schedule a thing for you, right? So that's kind of how I came to kind of build what I built.
Do you want to become more than just a technically apt person behind the projects who feels stuck, lost, and invisible? Wouldn't you rather attain higher remuneration, more recognition, and faster progression for your career? Become the exemplary, excellent, and exceptional constructor that you were destined to be in the industry. Head to theconstructioncoach.com.au and start your transformative journey today to construct your exceptional future.
How has operating and seeking these extreme environments made you a better entrepreneur?
I probably am, but for me, the value is at the edge, right? And so if you look at historically over the last 500 years, you know, the folks that were making, you know, a lot of money or creating an impact, let's say 500 years ago, were the folks that were jumping onto boats and sailing off into the unknown with, you know, compasses that barely worked and not a great GPS system, to put it mildly, right? And that was the edge then, right? That was what we were sort of, you know, trying to uncover, right? And, you know, throughout history, that edge has shifted and changed, right? What's really interesting is that, you know, today, if you look at it, it's really technological, right? You know, applying the latest technology to various problems is kind of where that edge is. And so I think that it's almost a chicken and egg problem. So what is it about, you know, this life philosophy that has led to being a better entrepreneur? It's almost like, to me, to be a really good entrepreneur, you've got to like this discomfort. You got to like the edge. You got to like to go to places where there's a lot of failure and a lot of people make fun of you and a lot of people tell you that what you're doing is stupid, right? And I've experienced a lot of, you know, all of the above. But at the same time, seeking the edge makes you better at being an entrepreneur, right? The more comfortable you are in these environments, the better of an entrepreneur you are. And so I think it's like incredibly intricately and intimately tied, those two concepts, right? Entrepreneurship and the edge. And I think they're almost like inseparable in some ways.
Absolutely. And it's a marker of entrepreneurial thinking to sit in discomfort for a really long period of time and not necessarily needing to have a solution and have a solution present itself to you now. And this is what you probably found when you were developing Alice, that the solution wasn't going to come overnight, but 13 years later, here it is.
Yeah, I mean, highly recommend the book for anybody listening. The best book I've read about innovation, it's called, and it was recommended to me by a venture capitalist here in Silicon Valley, and it's called How to Fly a Horse. It's a book about innovation, and it goes through, and I think it goes through about 200 years of human innovation, and it picks out, I think there's maybe 10, you know, examples that are, you know, studied in pretty fine detail. And the point of the book is that innovation, like, it's effectively failure, right? You know, it's you know, like Edison said, I didn't fail 1,000 times. I just found 1,000 ways that the light bulb won't work, right? And it's the same thing. It's like, you know, when they were, you know, 500 years ago, getting onto these boats and you know, floating off into the Atlantic or you know, wherever they were floating off to, there was a high degree of failure, right? You know, people would get scurvy and, you know, they would mutiny and they would get lost, right? And that's sort of really, you know, it goes hand in hand, right? It's the same thing, right? For us, like, you know, my PhD, You know, the first thing, you know, in the acknowledgments, I say, you know, this PhD is a result of 6 years of sustained effort and a result of 3 years of failure, right? And so, you know, at our company, right, it I always kind of joke, like, you know, sometimes it feels like at big corporations, it's like, well, we want you to be innovative, and as long as what you're doing is right, you know, like innovate, just don't fail, you know, whereas for us at our company, it's like, if you're not failing, you're not innovating, right? And for us, what we tend to look at is, okay, it failed. Why don't you share how you made that decision, right? What were the inputs? And if it was, you know, if it was a sound decision, it kind of makes sense. It's like, okay, great. Well, what did we learn? Let's move on to the next one. And to me personally, like I always say that you don't have anything of value until you're in version 6 or 7. So when someone, you know, what I always tell everybody at the company is if somebody tells you that you're wrong, right, or that you could have done it differently, don't take it personally. They're just giving you the next version of what you need to build. Like they just save you a little bit of time, right? Because you're going to need to do this at least 6 or 7 times before I look at it and I'm like, okay, well, that's now starting to look solid, right? And for my PhD, the PhD is made of three papers. I'm on version 33 on the first one, version 26 or 27 for the second one, version 24 for the third one. And a version means that I threw it out and started from scratch, right? And so you got to keep iterating, keep iterating, keep iterating, keep failing, keep failing, keep failing, right? And if you read that How to Fly a Horse, I mean, reading that book, I was like, oh my God, this is exactly what Building Alice was like. I mean, that's exactly it.
I'm fascinated by the title. I'll be downloading that as soon as we finish recording. And I'll, of course, put the link in the show notes for people to get into. But in speaking of failures, as you correctly said, it's a key part of the entrepreneurial journey. You can't be removed from it. So how did you overcome challenges and failures so as to not stop? Because most people, they experience one or two and then they quit for the next 30 years.
You know, I mean, that's truthfully what I realized is that's what the crux of the matter is, right? It's really, you know, you'd look at something like We've Built, right? And the truth is like, you know, there are 3 or 4 problems that we encountered that really required, you know, folks that, you know, we hired that were incredibly intelligent, right? And it really required a very large leap in intellectual power, so to speak, right? But most, like 99.9% of the stuff that we solved is just, you know, we tried it this way, we tried it that way, we tried, okay, this one worked. Okay, well, we tried it this way, we tried it that way, you know? And so what I've started to realize is that a lot of, there's a misconception around success and innovation and entrepreneurship, which is like, oh, you've got to be this incredibly talented person and you get this flash of lightning idea and you're like, I know exactly what I need to do, right? And you know, you kind of go build it and the world comes and you know, it's highly successful, right? You know, look at Elon Musk, right? I think he started SpaceX in 2002, I believe. Overnight successes are 10 years in the making, right? And so that's the question, you know, how do you not quit? How do you not? And I think that the answer, right, I could give you a canned response, which is, well, everybody's got to go figure it out for themselves, right? But I think that if what you like is that edge, is that feeling of the unknown, is that feeling of exploring, right? And anybody that does it, the one thing you can tap into is you've got, you know, 2 millennia of human history that you start to realize like, oh, all these other folks were in a similar situation. All these other folks went through that same level of discomfort, right? I'm not the first one to take these kind of risks, right? And I think that if you lean on that and if you lean on, you know, the 2 millennia of explorers that have come before you, that, you know, should offer a little bit of help, you know, going through it. But like I said, ultimately it's you either like that, you know, feeling and that's why you're doing it, right? Or else you're going to run out of steam. Right. And what's interesting is if you're doing it for the money, if you're doing it for the fame, if you're doing it to buy the pretty car, or, you know, the prestige or whatever it is, like that stuff tends to run out. Right. And so it's ultimately, and what's kind of interesting about the journey is you can start doing it for, you know, the pretty car or the money or the fame or whatever the heck it is you're doing it for. There's nothing wrong with dipping into, you know, what I call the dirty fuels at some point when you're out of steam. Right. But ultimately, that personal journey of having to find within yourself the real reason why you're doing it, right, is, I think, part of the advantage that you get or the cool part of the journey, right, which is this philosophical exploration of yourself, right? To quote Reinhold Messner, the first guy to climb Everest without oxygen, and I kind of paraphrase here, but he said something like, we don't climb Everest to explore the mountain. You know, I climbed Everest to explore myself. And that's really fundamentally what it boils down to.
That's right. The character building and who you have to become in order to achieve such greatness in the entrepreneurial world. You can't buy that experience. You can't get that experience in corporate. And it certainly doesn't come from staying within your comfort zone. But would you be able to share a few more characteristics of the mindset that you've had to develop that allows you to focus on what you want and can do rather than the opposite?
You're asking some really interesting questions.
I have a tendency to do that.
Okay, so here's what I can tell you. So I max out at 132.5 hours a week. Peak performance, I can sustain about 20 and a half hours a day of output. I haven't figured out how to knock it down below 3.5 hours of sleep a day, right? That's, to most people, sounds insane. It takes, you know, probably 2 or 3 weeks of like warm up to get to that point. The key metric that I look for is concentration span. So just like muscles, if you go running, you know, if you go running every day, you'll start to be able to run longer and longer, you know, faster and faster. With the mind, it's concentration span. And so what's unfortunate about today's technology is that there's such an incredible amount of pressure to reduce that concentration span, right? If you look at, you know, social media, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, like the input process output cycles have now been compressed to sub 10 seconds, right? Even sub 1 second in some cases, right? And so that really destroys this mind's ability to be able to focus on long-term tasks, right? And so to me, you know, the way I would do it, right, is I would sort of say, okay, when I'm untrained, like let's say that I take, you know, 2 or 3 months off, that's many years ago, but when I come back to working, I've had times when my concentration span is about 5 minutes. But the way the mind works is that, you know, you concentrate for 5 minutes and then you sort of, you'll kind of want to do something else. And you say, okay, well, let me focus in 5 more minutes, right? And your brain will start to play these standard tricks, right? You'll think, hey, I need to clean the house. I need to look at the internet. I need to check my phone. I need to, you know, text my significant other or whatever it is. And then, you know, then at some point you'll start getting sleepy, right? That's another trick the brain plays, right? And if you kind of push through this, very quickly you'll end up in a situation where your concentration span starts to get to 3 hours, 4 hours, right? And I feel that that's really when you can start doing some heavy lifting, right? Once you get to that sort of 3-4 hour mark, right? I've had times when I was working on the PhD where I could, you know, I've done 14-hour stints, like just in one go, right? I'm just lost in the work. And I don't know, it probably sounds crazy, but there's just a lot of joy, right, that I would find in applying myself to something, right? And like being this, you know, intimately connected to this thing that you're focusing on, right? And so, and again, it was like, to me, like, you know, I reached the point where I was capable of doing, you know, 16 hours a day. So I'm like, huh, like, what do I need to, like, that's the thing, right? I'm always kind of curious, well, what, how could I pull 17 hours off, right? I could do 18, right? Like what, you know, and then it requires like, you know, for me, I started to learn, like I needed, you know, the temperature in the room has to be exactly 74 degrees Fahrenheit because, you know, it's not too hot, it's not too cold. My body's not using energy. Like the seating position has to be the right one. The diet, the time that you eat, what you're eating, exercise. So, you know, you need to do 3 or 4 hours or 3 or 4 sessions a week of 30 minutes of exercise to help psychologically, right? Like, you know, to me, it's just finding different ways to squeeze more performance out of the system. And that's fundamentally, I mean, I enjoyed it. I liked it. It was an incredible journey, right? And I got to discover all this cool stuff. And during the PhD, I developed this, you know, mathematically derived Pareto efficiency fund. Right. I was the first person in the world ever to figure this thing out. You know, I woke up the next day and I was like, I know something that no one else knows, you know, like that's a really cool feeling. Right. And like, that's that explorer spirit. Right. Like, and the truth is, I think everybody's got it. Right. It's just that, you know, unfortunately, you know, the way we grow up, like so much is beaten out of us through our lives. Right. You know, the explorer spirit, the creative spirit. You know, it's like, you know, people, you know, aren't encouraged to create, right? Because we're so oversaturated with like these, you know, world-class, top-notch performance artists, you know, whether it's visual or music or anything else, they were like, oh, every other creation compared to that sucks, where we don't stop to appreciate something just for creation's sake, right? So, yeah, I think that it's a, you know, maybe an unorthodox way of living, but weaning yourself off, you know, the head of Facebook growth was at the Stanford Business School. I think it was about 4 years at this point, 4 years ago. And he said the sentence that caused a bit of a splash, which was, I truly regret the short dopamine cycles that we have unleashed upon the world. And it's kind of, you know, I guess endemic, you know, to what you witness around you today, which is there's such a large amount of pressure. I stopped using social media about 3 years ago completely. There's such a large amount of pressure to continue on these like cheap highs, cheap sugar highs, right? You know, the next social media post you read, right? The next movie that doesn't, you know, maybe mean too much, or the next, you know, event that you missed or whatever it is, right? And so weaning yourself off these quick highs, so to speak, is extremely scary. It's very painful. But, you know, trust me, like if you do that, it, you know, 3 months down the line, you start to really kind of wake up and you're like, wait a minute, you know, like social media, right? Like I remember when I quit, I was like, what the heck? I'm going to miss everything. Like, oh my God, all these people are going to do all this cool stuff without me, right? And then you know, 3 months down the line, you're like, wait a minute, I'm actually uncovering or unlocking this whole different, you know, value system, right? And so that, I think, you know, from what you're somehow getting the tricks of the trade out of me, but what I told you is I think the way to get it done, right? The fundamental question is it's about fuel, right? That's the question. If you've got the fuel, the rest is easy, because everybody else focuses on everything else. It's like, well, you know, what's the idea? What's the this? What's the that? The only thing that matters is the fuel, because if you can chisel at something for 13 years, you'll get there, you know?
It's a sheer mathematical probability.
Yeah. You know, it's like that joke, like 100 million monkeys, you know, typing on 100 million typewriters for 100 million years will produce a Shakespeare novel at some point, right? You know, but I mean, it's true. It's like it's human nature that you'll keep chiseling, you'll get to somewhere of value, right? But the interesting thing about it is if you ask someone like, hey, would you work on something for a year if it was going to be this like big successful company, right? And everyone's like, yeah, absolutely. But there's like this huge fall off, right? Like run that experiment with like 3 years, 7 years, 10, 13, 15, 20. The number of people that would say yes to hammering at something for 20 years is like tiny. You know, it's basically zero.
That's right. And that was one of the first things that my mentor said, that it's not talent that wins you the championship, but it's that diligence and consistency, because people fall off because, as you said, they don't get that hit straight away. They don't get that win as quickly as they thought that they would, and it never comes. And this is where people say, well, you know, this game isn't for me. No one wants what I have to do. They're not willing to iterate, so on and so forth. But you've got an interesting blend between the academic world and the entrepreneurial world. And this is just an oversimplification for the purposes of the question, but the entrepreneurial world relies on the imaginative faculty of your mind, whereas the academic more heavily relies on the intellectual part of your mind. So how have you approached that to truly be successful at both?
It's a great question. So I did get to do something really rare, which is I got to go from conceptual research to theoretical research to prototyping to commercial, like industrial grade software, to then commercialization, right? And that's extremely rare to do for one person, right? And the reason that I, you know, I think got to do it is because of the fact that construction is not as developed as other fields, right? It's a lot harder to do in fields that are developed, right? But to answer your question, the difference between academia and entrepreneurship, academia is about intellectual rigor, entrepreneurship is about you know, invention, right? Or imagination, right? And Einstein's got this quote, you know, he says, imagination is far more important than intelligence, right? I thought that the imagination piece, you know, the kind of creative, like, sitting back and wanting to create a masterpiece was equally important in academia and entrepreneurship, right? For me, right, I'm not a great painter, right? I'm not a great musician, right? I know, you know, what my skill set is. I am really good at working with these abstract ideas. I love theoretical physics, quantum mechanics, math, right? That's the kind of stuff that I liked. And like, for me, I like to create these theories. And so imagining these theories, like, you know, for me, the PhD that I wrote, like, to me, it was a work of art. It was literally like a symphony, you know, and it kind of unraveled and unraveled and unraveled. And then it sort of started to converge and it, you know, ended up in this one figure that explained everything, right? But the imagination, I think, is equally important in both parts of it. And I would also say, I had an advisor, you know, my PhD, that pointed this out to me, that it's not just the imagination, but also this like artistic side to what you're doing, right? And there's this, and I don't know who said this quote, but, you know, we must create things of beauty, right? And it's like, why? Well, what else is left? And if you, like, to me, it's really, really important. Like, even when I wrote the PhD, it was like, okay, you're done. And I said, it's not pretty. It's not elegant, you know? And I took 6 months to make it elegant. But I think that that's equally important in both arenas, right? You know, the imagination, which is, you know, envisioning something that's motivated by wanting to create something beautiful, right? And the thing about beauty is you know it. Like, it kind of hits you on the nose, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know that, like, this is, like, yes. You know, when I was, like, writing that PhD, like, there's this, like, moment. It was just, like, click. Like, that's it. This is the work. It's done. It's complete. It all adds up. And it's not perfect, but it's as perfect as I can make it. And like that moment, like it, you know it, like, you know that you've reached it. And that's, I think, yeah, important in both arenas, right? I think that, I guess the other thought that comes to mind is, I mean, that's the other thing that the world kind of has done, right? Which is really, it tells you that you're an engineer or you're an artist or you're a, you know, a construction person or a chemical, you know, whatever it is, right? The truth of the matter is that, like, human beings are a blend of all of these things, right? And so, like, the advice that I would give anybody would be, like, no, you can, like, you know, construction, right? Like, you know, people are like, oh, it's a backwards field. It's not innovative. It's not sexy, et cetera, right? Where, like, the truth is, like, if you dig into the actual problems that we're solving and you start looking at them from an algorithmic perspective, we actually, what most people don't realize, solve the biggest, most complex operational problems in the world. And there's an incredible amount of beauty that you can uncover there, right? And so, yeah, you know, it don't let people pigeonhole you into something, right? You can be an artist with whatever you do, and you should be, you know, so.
I couldn't agree more. And that was a very eloquent and beautiful answer. Thank you for sharing that. And when we really look at what imagination actually is, there is absolutely no bounds to your imagination. But I want to circle back before we talk a bit more about thinking and imagination. And that is the relationship between humans and technologies and how you've really worked to optimize yourself and to really get the best out of the relationship with technology and tech advances faster than human comprehension and also ability. So what else do you think are some of the key considerations that humans need to consider in the face of rapidly changing technology?
It's a good question. Here's something that hasn't changed in the last 500 years. And what hasn't changed is the role that the human spirit plays in the arena of technology, right? Or the role that the human spirit plays with the introduction of technology into the human arena, right? And what I mean by that is that, like, what you see over and over again, right, is that the human values of courage, of honor, of perseverance, of excellence, right, of discipline, tend to be the differentiators, you know, at the end of the day, right? And so the technology, like, the truth is, like, what's kind of been interesting in the AI world is watching, you know, what is AI eating, right? And here's what I mean by that. So when AI started, I think John McCarthy, Stanford guy, Stanford professor, kind of coined this term artificial intelligence. I think it was in the 50s, you know, not early 60s. You know, back in the day, AI, back in those days, AI, you know, would work on, like, really simple problems, right? If-then statements, right? At some point, they, you know, in the 80s, they started working on, like, chess games, right? That was kind of a big thing, right? Suddenly, at some point recently, maybe 5 years ago, suddenly the English professors became sort of hot cookies on campus because AI was eating language, natural language processing, right? Visual, right? You know, stuff, right? What AI has not started to eat, right, is and what I'm, you know, looking forward to seeing at some point in my life is when artificial intelligence starts to eat philosophy, right? And so the one thing that the machines don't have, right, at least I'm unaware of anything remotely close to this, is a consciousness. And the reason I make that distinction is until that happens, they're just tools. They're just machines, right? You know, and people, they get all fired up whether, you know, is it the real artificial intelligence, or is it neural networks, or is it deep learning, or is it machine learning, or, you know, the latest kind of buzzword of the day, right? But, you know, at the end of the day, I kind of look at all this stuff and I'm like, well, they're algorithms, right? The truth of the matter is, like, how are those algorithms, how are you using those algorithms, right? And the one question that I sort of, you know, thought, like, if I was running a business or you know, one question that anybody should ask themselves is, how many machines do I control, right? Because the cost of acquiring and firing up new servers is negligible these days, right? And so how many machines do you control and what are they doing for you, right? The question you asked was, what is the interplay between technology and human? And what I'm explaining is, until the technology has a consciousness, it will always be something that we use and leverage. So we always, you know, I often get asked, like, oh, is Alice going to take someone's job? Or, you know, is Alice going to, you know, eliminate somebody? You know, I almost wish that was the case, right? But if you look at the last, you know, 100 years of the Industrial Revolution, where the cost to write a letter, you know, and send it across the world has gone down, whatever, 100,000-fold, right? The cost to turn on the light has gone down 10,000-fold. The cost to, you know, print documents, the cost to calculate things, the cost to, you know, all of the things that we needed to do, the cost to transport goods from one place to another, right? And yet we are still working 40 hours a week, right? And the reason is that we all view ourselves as producers, right? Whereas I think, you know, if I've kind of figured this out correctly, unfortunately, our primary goal is to be consumers, right? That's what society kind of, that's why we keep working 40 hours a week, right? But, you know, until that, the machines start having a consciousness, they will continue to be things that we use and leverage to get done what we need to get done. And it will again boil down to, how well are you leveraging technology around you? And that boils down to, again, you know, how disciplined are you? How, you know, what's your level of excellence, like those kind of things, right? So I don't know. I think it's a good answer, right? In the sense that I don't see the machines threatening the human race anytime soon. But, you know, if you listen to Elon Musk, that's, you know, he thinks it's inevitable.
That was a deeply fascinating answer. And I actually have never heard that perspective about the interconnection between the spirit and the consciousness and artificial intelligence. But yes, I certainly do agree that it is a tool. It is just a tool, and how we use it and how we control our relationship with it is still very imperative. But I just want to circle back on that imagination piece, because I found out recently that it took 52 years from the invention of the CD through to the iPod. But that's a very slow progression. But the centuries that we're now going into, that time frame of innovation is going to be exponentially reduced. Like that analogy of a letter, it's going to become far more common. So how can people, I don't want to say capitalize, but how can they jump on this trend of innovation and really increase their imagination, work on their thinking so they can see these opportunities, so they can think in the direction of these opportunities and to have an innovative mind?
So the thing that comes to mind, there's a futurist in Silicon Valley, a gentleman called Ray Kurzweil. And I was trying to look up, he has a online document, a manifesto of sort. And I was trying to see if I could find it. But in that manifesto, he talks about the law of accelerating returns, right? The fact that things are getting faster and faster. Innovation is getting faster and faster. The you know, what you said is the invention of the CD to the iPod was 52 years. You know, from the iPod to the iPhone, you know, it's probably 10 years. From the iPhone, the next thing will be like 2 and so on and so forth, right? And so it is getting faster and faster and faster, right? I think that what's interesting about, so here's something that I've noticed. If you look at a place like Stanford, right, which is really sort of prides itself on being at this cutting edge, bleeding edge, you know, of everything, right? If you look at what they were teaching, say, don't know, 80 years ago, 100 years ago, right, in the 1920s, a lot of what they were teaching is like stringent thought, right? And so, you know, what I'm trying to explain is that it's a way of thinking, right, more than what they're actually teaching you that I think is valuable. And instead of the 1920s, you know, 1900s, 1890s, you know, think in terms of the railroad barons, the big kind of thing then was to be, you know, stringent and diligent in the calculations that you're making, right? So if you were to build a railway from, you know, point A to point B, to calculate, you know, how many, you know, kilometers of steel, you know, steel track you would need, and to calculate how much cut and fill, how much soil you'd have to cut and how much soil you'd have to fill, and which way you take the railroad track, and, you know, to calculate out the logistics, right? And that, I think, was a big change or step forward in human thinking, right? In terms of, you know, using kind of gut sense, if you're looking at the 1800s, right, Victorian times, you know, there was a lot more gut sense kind of, you know, there's a gut sense approach to solving problems, whereas, you know, the 1900s was a lot more about being very structured and ordered in your thinking and being mathematical in your approach, right? What you're seeing now at a place like Stanford is what they're teaching is this rapid, you know, adoption, assimilation, and moving on to the next thing, right? Like try, fail quickly, right? Maybe is a good way to kind of, you know, explain the ethos, right? And so the ability to pick up technology rapidly, I'll give you an example. I was sitting, you know, with a bunch of much younger kind of students. They're all, I think, you know, 18, 19, you know, 20. And they were talking about, you know, inviting, you know, somebody prominent, this prominent speaker at the university to give a talk on sustainability. And I mentioned this tool that I had heard of. It was a tool, something like Map Minds or Mind Maps. You know, it allows you to kind of very quickly draw these really cool charts. And I mentioned it just in passing, and I kept continue talking about something else. And, you know, 5 minutes later, somebody in the group interrupted me and said, "Hey, is this what you meant?" And the person turned their laptop around, and on the screen, you know, I realized that they had literally in this conversation got online, downloaded the software, tinkered around with it, uploaded the ideas that we had in, and created this mind map of what we were talking about. And I remember kind of being kind of stunned by this. I was like, holy cow, like that's faster than what I've encountered before. But that kind of thinking, right, is what I think you need to be successful moving forward. And it's hard, right? I mean, humans don't like to change. You know, I don't like to change, right? You know, and I've been trained to do it my whole life. Like I work in change, right? But yeah, I mean, that's kind of, I think, the way to go about, the way to set your mind up to be a lot more absorbent of different, you know, ideas and different approaches, right? And to constantly kind of try things.
That's right. And it's also looking at your current operating environment and thinking, what actions do I need to now do? Because you can't rely on, you know, the thinking of the past to still be applicable to where you are today.
Yeah. So again, I think Einstein said, you know, you can't use the same thinking that created the problem to solve it, right? And that's true, right?
Exactly what I was thinking of. Renee, as we've been talking, there have been, I think, a lot of overarching themes and principles that have been guiding what you do in any arena that you are working in. So what are your guiding principles and values that really do overarch all the work and contribution that you deliver?
I mean, for me, it's like seeking that edge. You know, it's pushing the boundary, exploring, going where no one's gone before, right? And that's something that you'll see over and over and over again. And doing it within ethical boundaries, right? You know, I think like being a good person is just so fundamentally important to who we are. Like, you know, it kind of ties into that concept of, you know, we must create things of beauty, you know. And I learned this in Afghanistan, right? Why and what else is left, right? I mean, that's fundamentally what I think we need to do here. And that's kind of, I think, what I learned there, right? Which is, you know, you learn two things. One, I really don't want to die. Two, I'm really going to. So then becomes a question. Yeah. Becomes the question of like, okay, so if that's the case, what are you going to do with your time here? Right. It's consciousness is an incredible privilege, right? It really is. It's this incredible, incredible gift with a lot of downsides, right? But yeah, I think that to me, what I realized was like, okay, what really drives me is the edge. right? What really drives me is, you know, this being a good person, kind person, bringing light to the darkness, and combining those two things to create an impact of something I can leave behind. And that, like, that's basically it. That's the core engine. That's the core ticker, so to speak.
I love what you said about consciousness, because we are the only species on this earth who can create our own reality. A dog can't do that. A cat can't do that. A lion can't do that. But we have that ability. And I think one of the most beautiful moments in people's lives is when they become cognizant of that and realize how deep and powerful they actually are.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I've really sort of one of the latest things I've realized is this the greatest question that you'll probably ever answer is, how do you want to propagate your consciousness onto those around you, right? On the global consciousness, the consciousnesses around you, right? And I think that, to me, you know, I started to read a whole bunch of Stoic philosophy, Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, or The Daily Stoic. I forget the author's name, but The Daily Stoic is like a little one-page meditation for each day, and I bought it for everybody in the company. And the Marcus Aurelius book is something absolutely incredible. I mean, I tend to read a paragraph, you know, for a day, and that's kind of enough, and I kind of go think about it. But it's 2,000 years old. I mean, this writing, and it really, I mean, makes you think of, like, you know, wow, like, you know, 2,000 years later, and we're still kind of dealing with the same questions of you know, control and integrity, and you know, what can I really impact around me, and who should I be? So, yeah, highly recommend those texts.
You know, all of this may sound simple to other people. It's like, oh, you know, I'm not going to meditate and then unlock my full potential. But it actually very much is the case. And when we're thinking about mastery and optimization of self, it's actually just mastery of quite basic things. But just because something is basic, it's also simple not to do. And that's where the real superpower and that human consciousness of knowing that this is what it means to be human has to kick in.
Yeah, I mean, it's all in those texts. I mean, you know, we think that we kind of figure something out, you know, here in 2021, and then you open this book from, you know, 200 BC, and you're like, oh, they're like there's three steps ahead of me. Like, how? You know? But yeah, it's funny. I mean, this meditation, like the thing I wish I knew earlier, right? Like, learning how to quiet down and do nothing is incredibly powerful, right? Because and like with everything else, it tends to be that like 3 to 6 months period where it's painful and you're like, why am I doing this? And I don't really get it. And then suddenly at one point, you're like, oh, I get it. Like, if I just quiet down, then I get to access all these other motivations. Like, if I shut the social media off that's kind of twittering at me, you know, 50 miles a minute, you know, 50 tweets a minute or whatever it is, maybe I can start really accessing these much deeper, quieter motivations, right? Which is ultimately what lets you kind of build, you know, big things, I would imagine.
Renee, your insight is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, for you to be thinking in this direction and asking these types of questions is obviously a testament to how much you have invested in your person, how much sheer insight and history and, you know, so many different complex systems you've had to take in, distill, and create, you know, a new model of reality for yourself. So thank you very much for sharing both the depth and breadth of everything that you have, you know, come across. And I know we haven't even scratched the surface, but in order to wrap up, I do have a signature question, and that is, what is the key building block in your life that has been imperative to getting you to where you are today?
I think I've explained it, you know.
It's the edge.
Yeah. I mean, it's this exploring piece, and yeah, philosophy is not something to be read. It's something to be lived, you know, and like exploring yourself, like that's kind of fundamentally all that it really boils down to, right?
That's right. Mastery of self is, I think, one of our fundamental duties of a spirit that is having a human experience. And what I find is that the more that we gain our knowledge in a linear fashion, the more, which is the becomes the known knowns and the known unknowns, the more that our unknown unknowns increase exponentially. I think at the end of the day, we find out that we don't actually know anything at all.
You know what they say, right? You know more and more about less and less till you know everything about nothing.
Yes, well, this isn't certainly to get esoteric with the audience, but that's very much what the experience feels like. And the people who can really sit, as you were saying before, sit in that discomfort and also run to the discomfort are those that actually even start to teeter on the edge of their potential. And, you know, we'll talk about history. When you look at how much has been achieved over the last 2,000 years versus how much is going to be achieved now, we haven't even cracked, I think, the full capacity and the potential of a human. So exciting times ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be an incredible ride, that's for sure.
Renee, thank you so much for sharing, again, the depth of your person and the depth of your insight on the show. I don't say this often, but I would love to have you back and continue this conversation.
Yeah, anytime. It definitely very enjoyable, and you asked some really, really good questions. Not the usual type.
Not at all. Renee, thank you so very much for being on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks, Eleanor. Have a good day. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. If you loved this episode and know someone else in the industry who wants to achieve more and succeed on their own terms in their career by learning from the best, then please share this with them. You can also tag me on social media, sharing your greatest takeaways. And of course, I'd love to see you in the free Constructing You podcast Facebook group to be part of the growing community. Until the next episode, I want to see you win. Here's to constructing you.